With Breaking the Cycle, we wanted to tell the story of those within the social, supported and charity housing sector. But we also wanted to touch on the psychological challenges faced by all those within society. This short episode is with psychologist Dr. Vanessa Moulton, and it's all about addiction. Vanessa, what is addiction?
Probably the easiest way to kind of define it is effectively something that you have effectively lost control over doing or using or taking, and to the point where it has become unhealthy or harmful for you. And there's, you know, as you would imagine, there's some common things that are associated with it. And that includes kind of gambling, drugs, alcohol, smoking, and also, you know, things like food actually is actually something that you can become addicted to in the way that you use it.
So, and with that, is it the addiction purely psychological or can it be a physical addiction?
100% it can become a physical addiction. And that's one of the reasons why it, especially with something like with drugs or something, you know, smoking that has something in it, like nicotine, it affects your physiology to the point where you crave it or it feels like you need it. So 100% it affects the physiology of your body as well as your mind.
And then if we look at how you become addicted, obviously there's a plethora of ways, I'm sure, but can you talk about some of the most common ways of how we physically and psychologically become addicted?
Yeah, as I say, there are a number of different reasons why you might become addicted to something. Let's take, I don't know, the first one being it makes you feel good. So obviously in certain situations for certain people where they struggle to get to a place where they're feeling good about something, they might use drugs or alcohol or some other form of something that they do or they use to make them feel good. They experience that feeling and or a feeling of, for example, feeling mentally or psychologically high, and they therefore get the urge to use that thing again because they quite enjoy that feeling. And then if you keep using it and it's something that will physiologically cause a craving, then it becomes even harder to stop. And then that's where people start taking more of that thing or using more of that thing that is leaving them feeling good. Or also maybe perhaps it can be used to block feelings out. So if someone is struggling with, you know, high anxiety, stress, or just really tough emotions, people use things to block out those emotions.
And then with regard to learning it, you've mentioned, and we'll get onto why you would become addicted in a second, but if you could you learn it, can you see someone doing it and think that was acceptable and then you go that way, or is that just like an entry level? You know what I'm thinking, watching your granddad going to a bookmaker's when you was little, could you then learn that? Is that like an acceptable behavior?
Definitely. It's either something that you kind of potentially even just try yourself, or it can be something that you've seen somebody else do. Now, we all, and especially when we're younger, we learn different coping strategies primarily from our caregivers or the people that are around us. So if we don't have access to people who, let's say, help us deal with when we're upset about something in a healthy way, and they deal with it, for example, by drinking, that's something that you kind of go, oh, well, that's how you learn to deal with your emotions, or that's how you learn to deal with a certain situation, or that's how someone learns to feel relaxed and good. And therefore it becomes an accepted kind of behavior. So definitely what you're exposed to throughout your life, especially actually when you're younger, can impact the kind of the choices that you make around how you cope with things or what you deem to be is acceptable.
Is that because the brain's developing when you're younger, and is that with the childhood?
Yeah. So, you know, the developmental stages of the brain that we go through, we know that that's why it's so key when you're young and you're a child, that you learn the kind of the healthy skills around how you look after yourself and look after your mind, because your brain is literally like a sponge when you're younger. And the things that you are exposed to, your brain starts forming patterns and beliefs and rules about how you do things, how things are responded to, how you cope with things. And actually, you can learn those kind of those ways of being as a child, and you can take them all the way through your adulthood, unless someone, you know, gives you the opportunity to recognize that's not a healthy way of responding to something or behaving towards something. So the child, your childhood and what you're exposed to in your childhood is just so fundamental about how you are as an adult around either kind of coping or responding to just different aspects of your life.
And if we look at then, and I'll give you one specific, so if you look at why you would become addicted, and we have touched on it there, but I want to give you an example. So if, and we talked about children and developing and how your early life impacts you later on. You experienced trauma as a child. You experienced maybe bullying by your stepdad or an abuse from a family member. Later on in life, you may have blocked that out. And then later on, you develop a way of self-medicating, or you, these traumas start surfacing for whatever reason. The brain's relaxed, you're in a safer place, whatever. And then you need to start self-medicating to do what you just said, like block out. I don't know if I just answered the question. I don't know if I answered it there, but could you elaborate a little bit more on how past traumas can, I suppose, implement self-medication?
Yeah, I mean, there are different aspects that come to the fore and different things that we experience if we are experiencing, you know, feeling re-traumatized by something. And generally, it usually is coupled with quite strong emotions that a lot of people can feel really uncomfortable having to deal with. So as you kind of suggested, using alcohol, using drugs can for some people feel like the kind of the easiest way and the quickest way to either bury some of those emotions, not have to experience some of those emotions. We also know, a lot of the military work that I've done, and I've where people are struggling with something like PTSD, they have nightmares. And a lot of people will, for example, use alcohol because it's the only way that they can actually get themselves to fall asleep. We know that drinking alcohol will mean that you won't have a good night's sleep, but it perhaps enables people to fall asleep, which they will really struggle with if they're scared about having nightmares when they fall asleep. So it can be used for different kind of reasons if someone has been re-traumatized, for kind of numbing the emotions and dealing with the emotions, or actually, you know, certain aspects, which is simply like, I can't get to sleep without smoking marijuana, or I can't fall to sleep without having a certain amount of alcohol, which I've heard pretty regularly.
Also, as well, things like, and as you were saying there, you know, I know guys who have literally physically fitnessed themselves to sleep, where mm-hmm. you just got OTT on physical fitness to exhaust yourself to the point where you have to fall asleep because there is no, and it's not. So my point being there is it's not just, you know, these typical heroin, marijuana, alcohol. There's a lot of other factors around this, aren't there? There's a lot of the behaviors that if you become, like we said at the start, obsessed with something, if it becomes unhealthy, it can bubble over, I suppose, into an addiction.
Yeah, and that's what it's kind of like, this notion of it can, to a certain degree, it doesn't necessarily have to be drugs and alcohol, as you say. It can be anything. It's about when you use a behavior or you use something to the extent where it's actually not good for you. So again, I will always advocate being fit and healthy. You know, doing exercise is fantastic for your psychological health. But if you are, you know, beasting yourself to do two or three sessions a day, or you're going for a run at 11 o'clock at night, it's not good for you. It's not healthy, but that you are using exercise in an unhealthy way to be able to cope with something that you're going through.
And if we look at gambling, and again, this is a 3-hour podcast, gambling, but if we look at that, and one of the things I was really interested in hearing someone recently, and I thought, do they hate themselves, and are they trying to lose to make themselves feel bad?
That's a very that's a multi-layered complex, but there will be some people that will do it for that. And that's why, let's say for sake of argument, me with working with different people, it's all about understanding what someone gains from doing the thing that they are doing. So we talk about a secondary gain, for example. So you'll be talking to somebody, or I'll be talking to somebody who doesn't want to use what they are using, be that, you know, spending too much money, gambling, whatever, but actually they get some sort of gain from it. So it might be that that individual has such a high level of shame about something that they are effectively kind of, it's almost like a form of self-flagellation, where they are, you know, trying to cause harm towards themselves because they think that they deserve it. Equally, gambling can quite simply be used because from a physiological point of view, if you win, you get a massive dump of the hormone dopamine. It makes you feel great. It gives you a high, very similar to taking a drug. And you want to do that thing again. You want to feel that experience again, that high. So, you know, it's what the person is needing. It might be that they're lacking that aspect in their life. It might also be, you know, we see regularly people who are potentially, and I can't help but thinking about the kind of the ex-military group, whereby perhaps they've led a life where there has been a lot of risk taking, and actually they've become to enjoy risk taking. It's kind of part of who they are. They leave the forces, and that element to life is not there anymore. So they look for things that are risky behaviors, driving fast. Gambling, it's a risky behavior, but what it does is it provides that person with a sense of high which is lacking in their life at that point.
Can it remove joy in other things? Can it remove joy in going for a walk, spending time with your family, you know, these simple pleasures that are so meaningful? Can it remove what we'd call joy?
I would say so, definitely, because when something is addictive, it tends to take over. And when things take over, it tends to be something that's on your mind a lot. And generally speaking, if we're spending time with our friends, our family, going for a nice walk, if our mind is elsewhere and we're thinking about the next time we can go gambling, or the next time, you know, we can use the thing that we're addicted to, we're not able to fully immerse ourselves in the moment that we're in. So it's quite hard to experience joy, A, because you're not present, but B, because you've been getting a high, or your experience of what joy is has been translated into something like into gambling, for example, and nothing else kind of will kind of meet that level that you're looking for.
Mm. Could you give, this is the final thing, could you give us some possible solutions or some possible next steps if someone who is listening, either themselves or someone who they know, has an addiction, has a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I will always say, and we, you know, it's really important that your first port of call should always be your GP, because that they really are the kind of the central point of all of us getting the support that we need. There are, of course, other services, charities and websites out there that provide quite a lot of information around it. But I would always suggest that you contact your GP. You will have a local mental health team. It doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go to a crisis response at all. But the first step is just actually being open and saying to someone that, you know, do you know what? I think I'm struggling. Because then the care pathways and the different care pathways that are right for you as an individual will be given to you. And that's the key point, is there isn't one care pathway that's right for everybody. So actually your GP or a healthcare professional will be able to point you in the right direction to ensure that you get the right level of support that you need.
Thanks so much, Vanessa. We'll leave it there.